You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. To the second to last Monday in March. Then we're going to get to April. Baseball season was supposed to start, yeah, this week, maybe today. I don't really know that what day it was supposed to start, but I know it was this week. So you got that going for you. So on a Monday, welcome to All Marine Radio, the house that I built.
Morning comes and you know that you want to stay.
Close the blinds, so what did you do over the weekend? For those of you whose lives have been impacted, my life, not so much, man. I work from home. And Colleen was here, so I did yard work. Yeah. Got out to the front yard and the backyard. And then because this winter has been moderately wet, in my backyard, after I mowed and edged it, there is weed activity that is disturbing to me. And when I see it, it causes me anxiety. Or it kind of pisses me off. One of the, whichever you prefer. I don't, it causes me anxiety. That means, no, it doesn't. It pisses me off. So when I look up my sliding door, I look towards the side fence. And actually, I have two sliding doors. One looks towards the side fence out of the kitchen, which I most often look out. And there's weeds in the garden. And there's too many of them, right? And that pisses me off. And then when I walk out into the backyard, and I head towards the backyard itself, I kind of hang a left and go, okay. Yeah, there's like, the fucking Florida Everglades is growing in my, there's lawn, and then there's brick, and then there's this raised garden with fruit trees in it. You know, it's not very deep. It might be, I don't know, 10 feet deep. And like, yeah, it is ungodly with weeds. So on Sunday morning, I'd done both yards, on the front yard and backyard on Saturday. So Sunday, I walk out, and I'm like, okay, let me just do this little section. I'll do a section every day, and then, you know, I'll be done with it. And actually, I did some of the flower bed that I see as I look out the window, as I look out my sliding door. I did that part of the side flower bed. And it did not take very long. It took me, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half to do, I don't know, a fairly decent sized section of it. Right? Get on your hands and knees and start pulling weeds, man. Corporal Punishment Kathleen was big on that. Yeah. I hated it too. Now, again, for me, it's like cleaning. Yeah, my happy place. Now, I'm not so much, I like cleaning more than I like pulling weeds. But it has the same kind of transformational effect. So what I did was, I put on my audiobook, The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. And I will tell you this, I'm enjoying that book immensely. And I told my ass clown group of friends, Napa Man, F-18 Man, and Montana Man, I said, man, you guys need to listen to this because it's an awesome book. As Hornfisher, I think that's his name, as he develops the narrative, right? He starts, you know, post World War One, and the whole debate about battleships and carrier aviation, and he develops that as he develops the different people that have significant roles in the Battle of Samar, which is part of the Battle of Leyte Gulf, which is, you know, the story of Taffy 3, which is the story of the USS Johnston, the USS St. Lowe, the USS Samuel B. Roberts, and this amazing story. So, yeah, so I put that on. Yeah, and I went to, like, big Navy post-World War I carrier aviation development, and then they get to developing Ernest Evans. Now, I've got a little clip I'm going to play, and I was going to play it a little bit later, but I probably should play it right now. So I do for a couple hours on Saturday, then I work out, blah, blah, blah. And then we had board game night. Yeah, me, Colleen, my ex-wife Susan, she came over along with my daughter Catherine, and we played board games. We play Sorry, which is kind of you don't need to be that very smart to play Sorry, okay? And we play this version of it where when you, like, knock somebody's, like, piece off the board, like, you, like, kind of whack it across the room. So there's an element of aggression in it that always makes the game interesting. So anyway, and then when there's this other game that they bought, they have, and I like it, but it has to do with, like, it's the grid is a bunch of squares, and if somebody knows, send me an email and tell me what the name of the game is, and everybody has the same pieces, and everybody starts from a corner, and you have to build, and all your pieces are different sets of squares. It goes from one square to four squares in a straight line. It goes from one up, two over, one up, three over, one up, four over, two up, two over. So you have all these different shapes, and you have to piece them together, and they can only fit diagonally, corner to corner. So you can't have them touch, like, long access to long access. Anyway, so we played that game. I like that game. Yeah. Yeah, it's a kind of a decision-making game, right? Turning over the permutation as it develops in front of you dynamically. Yeah, so, and I like stuff like that. So anyway, we had pizza, and we had Chick-fil-A ice cream. Now, I don't know if you know the secret of Chick-fil-A ice cream. If you don't, then that's okay. It leaves more for the rest of us. That's right. It leaves more for the rest of us. But if you have not participated in Chick-fil-A ice cream, I would suggest today, because they're open. They're not open Sunday. But you should make an effort. Put it on your calendar. Go Chick-fil-A ice cream. Yeah, just tell me you want a large cup of ice cream. Well, you get a small one if you want to. Yeah, so we had pizza and chicken wings. We had pizza, chicken wings. We played board games. So that was Saturday. So Sunday, I wake up. I walk outside, and I look at the backyard. I look at the Everglades. I'm like, okay, let me just get a sense of how this is going to happen. So it might take me a week to get through this, and then the other side, right, is where Joe goes when he hides from me over there. So. Yeah, it's like Joe's, what's the bunker in the White House? That's where he goes. That's his bunker. So there's weeds behind this row of bushes, and that pisses me off because I look out of my kitchen window and I see that. Then there's weeds behind the garbage cans, and they go down the side of the fence that leads to the gate, which I see whenever I take the trash in. And all that stuff pisses me off. So now I'm figuring, okay, this is going to be a few days' work. Let me just get a sample of it. So then I'm like thinking, okay, this has taken me about 30 minutes to do this section. So this whole back fence would be about how long? It would be about, I don't know, two and a half hours. And then I'm thinking, no, that's not what I need to do. I'll take the weed whacker up there, and I'll just whack it, right? I'm not going to pull it. First effort, man, 75%. So I'm going to whack it, rake it, and get all that out of there. So I get the weed whacker, right? And I'm like living with the United States Navy because I put my headset on and I go weed whacking for I don't know how long, maybe an hour, and I whack everything. That's right. I'm going through weed whacking cord, and I have like industrial strength weed whacking cord. I'm going through that like it's nothing. So then I look at my trees, my fruit trees, and I'm like, those got to be trimmed. So now I pull a tarp out. Now I'm trimming trees. I'm trimming trees. Then I get to the corner where the fence, where Jack and Joe screw around. And somehow or other, I don't know how they did it, but they pushed on this dry-rotted fence, and they knocked a piece of it out. So now I've got to get some mesh that I have, some metal mesh. And ultimately, I'll replace the plank, but I have the metal mesh up there so those idiots can't get through. And now I've got to saw parts of this tree that is coming up through the fence that starts on the other side of the property. So I take care of that. I call Colleen out, and I say, okay, I need your help. So we're picking up stuff from the Everglades. And I look at now, the next target is the bushes right along the fence, you know, where Joe's bunker is. I'm like, Colleen, this is going to take us about 45 minutes to do that. So she and I get on our knees. She goes and gets a speaker. We get a couple of chaise lounges, the cushions for those. We throw them on the ground, and we start pulling weeds. And true to form, man, that thing, like, we ripped through it in less than an hour. And I look at the last stretch, and I say, and she says to me, are you going to do that now? I said, we have to. We have to. So we did. So then we knock out the last piece of it. It wasn't actually the last piece. It was one more section. I thought, okay, I could just lay. No, I couldn't. So, yeah, now I'm happy. And then last night, all of a sudden, started raining. Last night, and it rained pretty good throughout the course of the evening. So I don't know what's going to happen today. So that stuff all makes me happy. I would recommend it to you. Get after your yard if you have one. Yeah. I don't know if it'll make you happy, but it'll certainly burn up a weekend. That's what I did. Okay, so now I want to play you. So imagine this. So I'm in the midst of all that. Now, you've heard about the last tank stand of the Tin Can Sailors. You heard about the Samuel B. Roberts, and you heard about Ernest Evans. Medal of Honor recipient, right? Captain of the USS Johnston. Right, the only captain that ship ever has. He takes it at the commissioning ceremony, and he fights it till it sunk, and he's lost with the ship. His body's never recovered. He's after the Battle of Samar, he's posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. Now, I'm in the middle of weed whacking, right, and all of a sudden, the author, Hornfisher. Right? And he starts the section about who Ernest Evans is. Now, I'm listening to it, getting ready to go hysterical. Okay? Because I'm an Ernest Evans fan, right? I mean, the guy's straight up, right? In the Battle of Leyte Gulf, what happened? What the Japanese do, Japanese are on their ass, right? They don't have enough planes and pilots because we are chewing their shit up. Like, have you ever seen one of those thrashing machines? Yeah. That's what, like, chains flying everywhere and just ripping up everything. That's what we are coming across the Pacific. And not just our carriers, but we have, like, escort carriers. Escort carriers are, they're called CVE, right? And there's all kinds of funny names that sailors attach to CVE. It was essentially a flight deck placed on top of the hull of a tanker, of a merchant tanker. And then they, you know, there's a hangar bay down below. It had a third of what a normal carrier did. We pumped these things out at the cyclic rate. I mean, they were everywhere. So you could have like the Enterprise, or you could have the St. Lo, right, the Granite Bay, and two other aircraft carriers. And you have more aircraft, right, than, and if you lost one of them, you didn't lose, you know, you didn't lose the whole kit and caboodle, right? The aircraft, if they were up in the air, they flew to other, you know, other escorts. So anyway, this story is developed, right? And the story of, for those of you who don't know, the Battle of Leyte Gulf is the Japanese, right, are trying to deal a death blow to the invading force that's going into the Philippines. And they construct, you know, the Army and the Japanese High Command, right? They construct this plan to use the Navy in three separate elements. One in the south, one in the it's called the middle force, and then one in the north. Okay, the key to this thing is you got to get the big carrier away from Leyte Gulf. And that's what Admiral Halsey commands. So anyway, what they do is they take the southern force and they begin to move it from the south part of the Philippines around to the west. And they get into a fight there, and the Japanese get their heads kicked in. I mean, honestly, right? They get attacked by PT boats, then they get attacked by destroyers, then they get attacked by battleships and carrier aircraft. I mean, it's like they get annihilated. And then the center force is really the force. It's the biggest battle group that the Japanese Navy puts together in World War II. But they've got to get Halsey and the carrier, the I think it's the Enterprise, away from Leyte. So what do? They dangle bait in front of Bull Halsey, right? Which is one of the carriers that participated in the Pearl Harbor attack. Yeah. So they dangle that, and how do they dangle it? Well, they put it at the edge. They're tracking him with their submarines, right? They put it at the edge of his reconnaissance window. Right. And so they tease it up there, and the Americans spot it, of course. Right. They identify it. And what happens? Halsey could babysit the landing, but that's not his style. Right. You don't get the name Bull Halsey because you sit on your ass. Right. So he takes off to go carrier hunting. Right. Which was a big deal in World War II in the Pacific. And so he goes and he leaves essentially the defense of the beach at Leyte Gulf to Taffy 3, right? This task force commanded by a guy named Sprague, who's all these guys. The Battle of Samar, which is one of the battles in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, reminds me of Little Round Top, because the guys that are there. Now, let me remind you, these guys are B-team guys, right? Halsey and the Enterprise and, you know, the big carriers, right? They were the glamour pusses of the Pacific, right? And all you have to do is look at the movies and the videos about it, right? These escort carriers, right? They did the hard slugging and the dirty job, right? They would go back and forth to the west coast of the United States. They would load a bunch of aircraft, you know, to bring out to the Western Pacific. They would be involved in other battles, right? Roy Namur and Kwajalein and stuff like that. So anyway, the right hook is the center force, okay? So after the Japanese trick Halsey into sailing north, there's nobody near the beachhead protecting it. And then they send the middle force from the western side of the Philippines, transiting the San Bernardino Straits to the eastern side. And when it first gets seen by Americans, they're like, oh, that must be the remnants of Third Fleet. What are they doing up here? And then this guy driving, he played football at USC. he looks and he sees it and he's like, whoa, man, that's a lot of ships. What are they doing up here? And so he goes down and he sees the distinct, you know, the flying bridge, the elevated bridge that the Japanese used in the construction of their battleships. And he says, holy shit, those are Japanese. And he reports it and he gets told that's bullshit. There's no Japanese ships up there. Confirm your report. So he drops down to like 1,500 feet. And there's like 22, there's like battleships. There's like three battleships, like six cruisers, all these destroyers and shit, right? And so he drops down. And then he radios back like, yeah, there's the biggest fucking white flag with a red dot right in the center of it. I hope that's confirmation for you. And now they're within like, they get the spot report. They're within 20 miles. Well, listen, I mean, the range of a Japanese battleship is like 22 miles. So they're already within gunnery range. And they're all gulping going, where's Halsey, man? And then the word goes around like, Halsey left. And then it dawns on them, it's only us, right? It's only us between these guys and our, I want to say, three escort carriers. And in the back as of the Taffy 3 formation is Ernest Evans, right? Commander Ernest Evans of the USS Johnston and the Samuel B. Roberts, you know, he's their skipper by a guy named Copeland. And that's it. That's what's there. And so the way that the Battle of Samar reminds me of Little Round Top is every person at Little Round Top hits it on the screws in terms of decision-making and decision-making in time. They don't go sideways. They don't do the wrong thing, right? They see what's at risk. They assess it clearly, and they make a right decision, or they make it close to right, and then they evolve it. The same thing happens at the Battle of Samar. Now, it costs some of these guys their lives. And that's what I mean, when you listen to it, it's amazing what these guys thought and the way they reacted. Especially when you think about what we're going through, right? This time of great sacrifice and you know what's great, you know, this great challenge in front of the country. And you listen to this, right? That, you know, these guys, when they turned their ships, they knew they might not survive the afternoon. So anyway, a little bit different kind of sacrifice. So I want to play for you now. Let me find what the hell I did with it. I want to play for you, if I can find it. This thing about Ernest Evans. So imagine me doing yard work and here it is. And I listen to this. First of all, I'm going to tell you, the guy who reads it, he kind of sucks. I don't want to make this personal, but it's kind of nice. To me, you can do so much more to make a book come alive with your voice, right, and your inflection. But it seems he's reading it like it's a book. So forgive him for that, but listen to this. I want to introduce you to Ernest Evans. Ernest Evans wanted to be a fucking Marine, man. And I heard that and my head almost exploded in my backyard. I was like, what? How can this story get better? And it does. So I heard this yesterday. I want to play it for you.
The fighting culture of Taffy 3's third destroyer, the Johnston, was the product of one man's inspired leadership, that of its first and only captain, Commander Ernest E. Evans. When Evans arrived at the Seattle-Tacoma shipyard to oversee the fitting out of the brand new USS Johnston, DD-557, he impressed his crew immediately with the substance of his will. At the ship's commissioning ceremony on Navy Day, October 27, 1943, he informed his raptly attentive audience, "This is going to be a fighting ship. I intend to go in harm's way, and anyone who doesn't want to go along had better get off right now." As if to underscore the invitation, he added, Now that I have a fighting ship, I will never retreat from an enemy force. Something in the tone of his voice told his listeners that he was deadly serious. Not one of them accepted his offer to leave the ship ahead of whatever trouble he had in store for them. Indeed, he was serious. As an officer aboard the World War I-era four-piper destroyer Alden, Evans had witnessed the disaster of the Battle of the Java Sea in February 1942, in which a Japanese heavy cruiser force made short work of an Allied fleet. 2 weeks after the battle, Evans assumed command of the Alden. But he never expunged from his mind the sting of having to flee from the Japanese. In that sense, he came to the Johnston with a cross to bear. Evans had initially pursued military service with the dream of becoming a Marine officer, but an appointment to Annapolis is...
Did you hear that? Did you hear that? Right? Tell me you don't love Ernest Evans more now.
...escaped him. So in May 1926, at the age of 19, he said farewell to Muskogee, Oklahoma, and enlisted in the Navy. 13 months after his enlistment, he won entrance to the Navy Academy class of 1931 via fleet competition. His Annapolis midshipman's moniker, the Chief, would prove to be apt for at least two reasons. First, he was by nature always in charge. Anyone who met him could feel the way his charisma naturally filled a room. Then there was the matter of his proud Cherokee heritage. His ancestry was not overwhelmingly evident in his appearance. The set of his dark-browed gaze, the large chest, and the subtle smirk of his lips, accented by a neat black mustache, made him look like a somewhat stouter incarnation of Clark Gable. It was clear to all who met him that Ernest E. Evans was not a man to trifle with. He bestrode his narrow bridge like a colossus. The fighting spirit of his forebears animated him. Evans appreciated the hidden nature of things, the power of the unseen over the tangible. In matters of discipline, he generally preferred to let the idea of his wrath do the work of the actual thing. He never exploded in anger as Hathaway did. He seldom, if ever, upbraided a subordinate openly for poor performance. But then he seldom smiled either. He expected every man to do his job without any psychological ploys. Lieutenant J.G. Ellsworth Welch, Evans's anti-submarine warfare officer, remembered. Evans trusted people to do their work. If they failed, he let them. He knew instinctively, as they did, that they wouldn't fail him twice. He never quite had to spell out the consequences. The very thought that the skipper might become disappointed was enough. The Johnston's gunnery officer, Lieutenant Robert C. Hagen, said, "He had great faith in all of us, unbelievably so. I don't recall him saying a mean word to me the whole time. The captain was a true instinctive fighter. We were on a high-class ship because the captain was high-class." If Ernest Evans was not destined to be a Marine, he would settle 17 years after his enlistment for running a warship like one. That meant simply that he would take care of his men. He would also, soon enough, take care of Marines. In February of...
Now, imagine me. I'm in my backyard, losing my mind, because Ernest Evans, right, is like, I feel like I know him. I know that dude, man. He fights the ship like a Marine. Like, he sticks a bayonet on. It's the same thing. When he turns into wind, it's the same as when you hear guys talking about receiving the command, fix bayonets. Right? And you've heard people talk about that on this program, fix bayonets. Like, what? Yeah. No. Come about 180. Like, wait a minute. There's a whole goddamn Japanese Navy back there. That's right. Let's go, boys. Let's do this shit. I got the weed whacker and I'm losing my mind in my backyard.
Of 1944, during the invasion of the Marshall Islands, the Johnston drew shore bombardment duty to support Marines advancing against stiff enemy opposition.
Listen to this shit, okay? This is a... I mean, now it's like, oh, Max, he's like... No, it gets better.
on the islands of Kwajalein and Eniwetok. For Evans, it was not just another assignment. Beyond his generalized desire to grapple with an enemy, he had empathy for the mud-slogging grunts moving into the Japanese killing fields ashore. He knew this. He could well have been one of them. The Johnston got in close, sometimes so close as to pierce the veil of distance that usually stood between Navy men and conditions ashore. For many of the crew, it was their first sight of blood. According to Edward Block, a coxswain, a landing craft came alongside with young kids who had been wounded on the islands. They were brought to our ship because we were close into the beach and we had a doctor on board.
Now, you know how close you have to be? So you have the ships at support, right, are, you know, kilometers, miles off the coast, right? And then you have landing craft that are disembarking, you know, our Higgins boats at the time and the gators they used at the time. And Evans is inside of that, right? With his bayonet on the front end of his ship, for God's sakes.
To see those young kids lying there all shot up brought tears to my eyes, and I cried. There but for the grace of God. The crew of the Johnston witnessed more of it during the Marianas campaign, during the bombardment of Guam. Broadside to the beach, pounding the caves and the cliffs above with a full battery of 5-inch fire, the Johnston fired so furiously that the guns glowed red. Bob Hagen had to take the occasional break just to let the barrels cool. During a lull, Bosun's mate, First Class Bob Hollenbaugh, went below to check on Gun 54's handling room when he encountered a young Marine in the care of the Johnston's medical division. Hollenbaugh approached the Marine, who held fast to consciousness despite the gruesome fact that he had had an arm shot off, and asked him how he felt.
"I'm fine, sir."
The kid told the bosun's mate that he had entered the Marines just 9 weeks ago. "That kid looked like he was about 14 years old," Hollenbaugh said. "My God, what is this world coming to?" I'll never forget the expression on that kid's face. And he still had the presence of mind to look up at me and call me sir.
So now, I'm losing my mind. I'm weed whacking the shit out of my backyard. Colleen comes up to me, and I now have tears running down my face. Because we've all seen that guy, right? Arguing from the operating table in the surgical suite at Dwyer with the doctor saying, "You can't send me to Germany, doc, right? You can't send me there. Send me back. I can stay with this," you know? To the point that the doctors came over to talk to us about it. Like, what the fuck do you do to these guys? You know, we've never seen anything like this. Arguing, right, in the emergency room that you can't send me to Germany? So Colleen looks up. She says, "Are you okay?" Now, I know how to do this, right? I said, "Yeah, all this pollen or shit or whatever is making my eyes water." "Yeah, so I get out of that one, okay? But I'm listening to this shit, like, it's going to get better. Listen to this shit."
Evans cared about the kids fighting ashore. Time after time, he took the Johnston closer to shore than the Navy's bombardment plan specified. When his allotted number of shells were fired into the island, such quantifiables being carefully managed by higher command, he beseeched his superiors for more.
"Damn it, they need fire support, and we're going to give it to them."
Twice during the shelling of Guam, Evans boarded his wooden captain's gig, was lowered into the water, and motored over to the task group's flagship to ask for more ammunition.
Not ask for, right? Demand more. Because the message he probably got, why would a captain in the middle of a fight get in his wooden dinghy, right, and traverse water to go see whatever, the Commodore or the flag, whoever's in charge of the fucking ammunition? Because he's pissed, right? Because some jackass, right, will not give me the ammunition that I need to do my job, right? To do what I'm supposed to do.
He got it. We would pull away from our positions near the shore and reload with ammo and then pull back in to resume firing, Fireman Third Class Milt Pell said. At times, we were so close to shore that we were actually hit by small arms fire. In the first year since her commissioning, through six invasions, the Johnston never suffered a hit worse than that. The full court press gunnery duty placed a lot of pressure on the men directing the shooting. In Bob Hagen, one of the destroyer's senior lieutenants, Evans had the kind of gunnery officer the skipper of a fighting ship had to have. Of the 70 men in his...
Now, Higgins, right, he's the gunnery officer, okay? Now, this is important. I mean, in these, at Kwajalein, and I think Roy Namur and shit like that, they developed their gunnery skills on the day that they turn to face the Japanese, the center force. They knock the living shit out of it. They throw right hook after right hook after right hook, right? And their gunnery is absolutely amazing. And the reason it's amazing is because of how they practice it, what they did. They just didn't go out there and, you know, and throw, you know, and shoot. They got good at it. And listen to this.
His gunnery department, which included not only the men who manned and loaded the guns, but also the fire controlman and the gun director, and the radar men in the combat information center, the crews on the two quintuple torpedo mounts, and the ping jockeys on the sonar stack. Only seven had ever been to sea before coming aboard the Johnston. Hagen had pushed them hard in training, teaching them the job by rote and repetition. Training a green deck force, never a small task, was made more difficult still when the man responsible for that job on the Johnston, the chief bosun's mate, went over the hill the day before the Johnston was scheduled to go to sea. A ship had to have a chief bosun. If Captain Evans did nothing else to impress his crew, he would still have ensured their eternal gratitude for securing as a replacement chief bosun's mate, Clyde Burnett. Burnett was a child of the fleet. An orphan reared in South Texas by four different families, the Johnston's chief bosun's mate began his life of service in the Civilian Conservation Corps before enlisting in the Navy more than 2 years before the Pearl Harbor attack. Burnett had just returned from a tour of duty in the Pacific when Evans found him ashore at a Navy receiving station in San Diego. "The captain put the make on him," Bob Hagen said. "The guy didn't have a chance." As a superior chief bosun should be, Burnett was right hand to the captain. Ernest Evans relied on him as a liaison to his enlisted force. In turn, Burnett delegated their supervision and discipline to his capable first-class bosun's mates. Harry Longacre ran the first division, the 100-odd sailors who comprised the deck force on the forward half of the ship. His counterpart aft, boss of the second division, was Bob Hollenbaugh, a sharp, no-nonsense Indianan whose father, a machinist's mate in the Dante-esque boiler rooms of a World War I-era battleship, had counseled Bob to get a topside rating at all costs.
Dante-esque. How about that? Yeah, that's pretty good.
Hollenbaugh performed his duties cleanly and professionally, and with not a little relish. On a crew made up mostly of first-time seagoers, his, Longacre's, and Burnett's most vital contribution was their experience. Burnett proved to be a popular chief. The boyish 24-year-old with the lantern jaw and quiet manner watched over kids on the Johnston's deck force like a father. The kids who swabbed and painted and scraped and loaded supplies and took on fuel loved him like one. But forging a crew into a hardened fighting unit mostly required not love, but discipline and ruthless repetitive drill. In that respect, Evans prized Lieutenant Hagen's tough stickler's nature. He let his gun boss draw up the general quarters or battle stations assignments and gave him the discretion to call the crew to GQ most any time he liked. Hagen used that freedom liberally, so much so that the Johnston acquired its own inevitable nickname long before it reached a combat zone, GQ Johnny. When the klaxon sounded, the men raced to their guns and searched for targets. For anti-aircraft gunners, there were long nylon target sleeves towed by pilots, very brave pilots, from the nearby air station. Crews on the 5-inch mounts fired on sleds pulled behind tugboats, very brave tugboats, at varying ranges on the surface. It took a lot of drill for the crew's proficiency to live up to the precision of their equipment. Each of the Johnston's 5-inch gun mounts was engineered with the precision of an outsized Swiss watch. The turret assemblies were 3 stories tall, running deep into the bowels of the ship. Each gun mount sat atop an ammunition handling room, where crew loaded shells onto hydraulic hoists, dumbwaiters, that whisked the shells upward. Below the handling room was a magazine that fed all the handling rooms. Among the greatest innovations of the 1940s-era Navy were the radar fire control systems with which all new surface combatants were equipped. Unlike the weapons on the smaller destroyer escorts, the guns of a Fletcher-class destroyer were controlled centrally by its gunnery officer. Seated in the enclosed gun director platform high above the bridge, Hagen operated a 2-handled steering mechanism that controlled the aiming of the Johnston's 5 main gun mounts. When Hagen ordered the gun crews in the mounts to match pointers, the guns came into alignment with the director, and the gun captains relinquished control of their mounts to Hagen. At that point, the 2 men beside him in the gun director, the pointer and trainer, teenage enlisted men named George Himmelwright and James Busby, took over. They kept whatever they were shooting at fixed in the crosshairs of their telescopes, one for gauging bearing or direction, the other gauging elevation or distance. In heavy seas, the sight of a...
We do that all by computer now, right? They did it manually, and then it's all transferred to every one of those guns that's adjusted differently, blah, 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 blah. Pretty amazing.
Destroyer's 5 director-controlled guns swaying in unison to stay on target as the ship pitched, yawed, and rolled could be unsettling. This synchro-gyroscopic wizardry relegated the men manning the guns to auxiliary backups whose duties went beyond simple loading only if the system broke down. As long as range and target data kept feeding the fire control computer, they had no aiming to do and little discretion to exercise. Gun crews had only to pull rounds off the hydraulic shell hoist and lay them in front of the powder canisters in the sliding breech tray. Their most immediate challenge was to keep their fingers and hands from getting crushed between a heavy shell and the breech mechanism. In another day, eyesight was essential to gunnery. Optical rangefinders were useful to a point, but the critical work of spotting shell splashes and correcting aim belonged to those with the sharpest eyes. By 1944, even in its first generation, American fire control technology was so good that it could make a top performer out of a man who would probably have been unsuited to the job not long before. At age 17, having beaten out 60 applicants in competition for the honor, Bob Hagen arrived at Annapolis as an aspiring plebe, only to get sent home that same day for flunking a routine eye exam. He opted for the enlisted route, scraped paint for 2 years aboard the battleship Texas, then returned to the States to attend junior college and finish his bachelor's degree at the University of Texas. In his second bid for an officer's commission, Hagen attended the Reserve Officer 90-Day Wonder Program at Northwestern University. In September 1941 in Chicago, Bob Hagen at last got his...
Now, I know this is getting long, okay, but pay attention. Hagen's a gunner guy, and it's going to come back to Evans and the way they shoot, and then we'll start the show, okay? So just bear with me.
Ensign's Gold Stripe. Hagen saw action almost immediately off Guadalcanal as assistant communications officer and radar officer aboard the destroyer Aaron Ward. In a ferocious nighttime surface engagement against superior Japanese forces in November 1942, he took shrapnel to his left biceps, nearly bled to death from his wounds, and won a Silver Star for gallantry. Returning to the States to convalesce, he decided that he would rather pursue his career in gunnery than in communications. "The gun boss could fire 100 shots and hit once, and he's a hero," he said. "In communications, if you screw up in transcribing one letter, all hell breaks loose."
That's still true, because comm always sucks, right? Yeah, the comm people just get beaten like rented mules.
"And you've committed a mortal sin." I said to myself, "I'd rather be a hero." Hagen finished gunnery and fire control school in Washington, D.C., learning to use the gyroscopes and servo motors that ensured that imperfect eyesight would not impede his advancement. For certain specialized purposes, the Johnston's Mark 1A fire control computer and Mark 37 radar were better than any pair of spectacles, if rather more expensive to clean. Following her commissioning at Seattle-Tacoma during the Johnston shakedown cruise off San Diego, Hagen tackled the challenge of training his crew of inexperienced polywogs to operate the sophisticated gunnery system. "We were all so green. The gun crews didn't know what they were doing, and I wasn't so sure what I was doing either," he said. In the first days of shakedown, when drills were going poorly, Hagen rode a friend aboard another ship. "Stay out of our gun range. Anything can happen." He was in Captain Evans's thrall, eager to please his charismatic skipper. But the captain made it plain that Hagen was on his own in bringing his gunners to proficiency. This freedom to hang himself with his own hawser was nearly as bad as suffering under an ill-tempered micromanager. The pressure began to get to him. Bob Hagen was a nervous wreck during shakedown. Well-groomed and intense, a compulsive smoker, disdainful of repose, Hagen had an intellect as sharp as his personality. Intelligence and initiative were de rigueur for a destroyer officer. On a small ship, the performance of a few key individuals could make or break her. Hagen had little patience for those who struck him as slow or stupid. In drawing up general quarters station assignments, he distinguished the thinking men from rote operators, installing the latter in the sweaty jobs in the handling rooms and magazines, and the former in sonar, CIC, and fire control, where human discretion could make a decisive difference. Unlike his captain, Lieutenant Hagen didn't hesitate to dress down an underperformer in front of his shipmates. Aware of their growing resentment, he became cautious among the crew. When possible, he avoided walking the decks alone at night for fear an embittered sailor might accidentally knock him overboard. But many men were firmly convinced that Bob Hagen, like Clyde Burnett, was one of the best things that could have happened to the Johnston. In 6 weeks of drill, his program of training turned the gunnery department into a competent working team. Bosun's mate, First Class Bob Hollenbaugh, was especially sharp. The captain of Gun 54, mounted on the stern of the ship, had the initiative and savoir-faire to lead young enlisted men effectively. Hagen also had confidence in Lieutenant Jack Bechdel, his torpedo officer, and in Julian Owen, a resourceful gunner's mate with a knack for repairing broken machinery. The crews in the five main gun mounts, numbered 51, 52, 53, 54, and 55 from bow to stern, competed for bragging rights as the ship's fastest gun gang. An average rate of fire for a 5-inch 38 caliber crew was 15 rounds per minute. Gun 55, the rearward-most turret on the ship, got off 84 rounds in 1 4-minute firing drill, an average of 21 per minute. With results like that, Hagen dared to be
21 a minute. That's a round every 3 seconds, for God's sakes, man. So I'm weed whacking now, right? I've taken care of my allergies, and I'm just listening to this shit going, holy shit, man.
Began feeling his oats. Writing again to the same friend he had warned several weeks before to stay clear of his scattershot batteries, the lieutenant discarded all modesty.
You may now bring on the Japanese fleet. Before an opposing fleet appeared in his sighting telescope, however, the apprentice gun boss would first have to prove his proficiency in action against enemy shore targets. During the bombardment of Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands, Hagen wielded the hammer that Evans used to support the Marines.
Listen to this shit.
There, the strict training regimen and the engineered precision of the radar-controlled gunnery system came together at last. Captain Evans took the ship in close to the beach, dropping anchor to stabilize her as a gun platform on the northern edge of the landing zone, which frogmen from the Navy's underwater demolition teams had marked with navigation lights visible only from the open sea. Hagen was nervous as a cat.
He dropped anchor, for God's sakes, right? He dropped anchor.
Gripping his slewing handles with white knuckles as the destroyer closed with enemy shore gunners. They could have machine-gunned us to death, and we were trying to figure out how to defend ourselves, he said. All of a sudden, over the loudspeaker came this song and the lyrics, A Sleepy Lagoon. Hagen found that well-trained crewmen could bring humor to any situation. Call it the product of confidence. At close range, the Johnston's entire chorus of weaponry came to bear on the island. There was the sharp, ear-ringing bark of the five-inchers, the rhythmic thumping of the twin-mounted 40-millimeter machine guns, and the faster, metallic chatter of the single-barreled 20s. Men from a damage control party broke out rifles and made like Davy Crockett from the main deck.
They busted out M1s and from the deck of the Johnston. It was so close. And they're shooting at Japanese soldiers on the island, for God's sakes. But it gets better.
Lieutenant J.G. Ellsworth Welch took out his 45 caliber revolver, outstretched his arm, and enfiladed the distant enemy with the handgun.
Yeah, I don't know about that one, but we like the motivation, right? Everybody caught up in the moment.
From his perch in the gun director, Hagen spied a Japanese officer on the beach, waving a saber, rallying his troops to the fight, and thought, why not? He put the officer in the sights of his slewing device. The fire control computer clicked and whirred and zipped coordinates to the Johnston's five main gun turrets.
He's going to shoot five-inch guns times five against this Japanese officer with a samurai sword waving that shit around, right? Come on, really? Is he going to do that?
When Hagen closed the firing key, they all barked as one. The technology lived up to its brutal promise. The five-shell salvo obliterated the man.
Hello.
Mr. Hagen, that was very good shooting, called Captain Evans from the bridge. But in the future, try not to waste so much ammunition on one individual. Chapter 5.
How about that? Evans, man. I love that guy. Even more now. I mean, when I first heard about him and the stories and the videos I've watched and all that. But listening to that yesterday, so now I'm like, I hear that. I'm ready to throw the weed whacker over the fence. I don't even know why, right? But I'm so fired up. I'm so fired up. And now I'm like, I'm going to do all this weeding now. I've been inspired. So I would tell you, and again, Ohio Man turned me on to that book, right? He just emailed me. I've obviously read the print version and bought three copies for others. But now you've got me all geeked up about listening to the audio version. Good narration makes a difference. Just started Shattered Sword on Saturday. Well-reviewed book on the Battle of Midway. The you know what? To me, yeah, the monotone guy reading, this book is a drama. And maybe that his monotone is certainly okay for some parts of it. But this thing plays like a play. And ought to be read like one because of the incredible drama, heroism that happens there, right? That pulls victory out of the sure jaws of defeat. and it's only on the courage. And like I said, you hear all that about the gunnery and the work they put in, and then all of a sudden when Commander Evans, you know, brings the Johnston around 180 degrees and heads straight towards the Japanese fleet, right? It's not an accident that those guys whoop it on that day. It is the product of all their hard work, right? And they saved thousands of lives that day. And so, in case you can't tell, I'm moderately geeked about it. But anyway, I wanted to share that with you because I was just, I was so moved by it. Evans wanted to be a Marine. So on that note, good morning to you. Dedicated to Ohio Man for turning me on to the book, Horn Fisher for writing such a well-researched and well-written one. But ultimately, the sailors of the USS Johnston, led by a wannabe Marine, right? Posthumous Medal of Honor recipient, Commander Ernest Evans, to the sailors of the USS Samuel B. Roberts, who followed Johnston and you know, wrote a piece of history, United States naval history, that really I think is unparalleled in the Second World War. And I'll tell you what, the United States Navy in the Pacific, you talk about a tough, right, lead with your chin. I mean, at one point, I can't remember who, I think it's Sprague, who's the commander of Taffy 3. Out of 32 guys in his naval aviation class, or of his naval academy class, that went naval aviation, 8 were killed in aviation accidents. Accidents, not even in combat, in aviation accidents, you know, leading up to the war and during the war. I mean, so this was work not for the faint of heart. And so anyway, this is dedicated to that group of people.
Our flag comes to every You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, we'll check the weather. Then I just got a couple quick thoughts for you. And then Alex Holling is going to join us. The weather. Quantico, partly sunny, or no, cloudy in 43. Camp Lejeune, both East Coast has cooled off a little bit. Cloudy in 56 at Camp Lejeune. 29 Palms has warmed up. Partly sunny in 58. Pendleton, partly sunny 55. Camp Smith in Hawaii, dark cloudy and 69 degrees. Okinawa, dark cloudy and 66. In the Helmand province of Afghanistan, where Task Force Southwest still works, it is dark, cloudy, and 67. And in Iraq, in Al Anbar, it is clear, dark, and 66. Currently at the home of All Marine Radio, partly cloudy and 58, feels like 58. On our way to 64 with partly sunny skies. 64 again tomorrow and 62 on Wednesday. So that's a look at the weather. All right, I want to talk about a couple things. You can't shut down the nation. You can't. Okay. So what I think you're going to see in the not too distant future is, you know, there's got to be some decisions made relative to this, you know, 100% shutdown of the nation. So what's going to have to happen is, the first thing is, you know, testing's got to, you know, continue to be made available. And so that, you know, that's out there. The drive-through sites have to get stood up. And that's happening as we speak. Everybody's bitching about it. It's not as smooth as we want it to. Okay, those bugs will get ironed out. And then what has to happen is, you know, those people that are not susceptible to the virus, right? Younger, healthy, right? They've got to be allowed to go back to work. Okay, because the death rate in that population is, you know, zero essentially. Okay, and so the age interval of that has to be defined. So that has to happen. Now it should start first and foremost in the areas that aren't largely impacted by this. So all you got to do is look at the map. Not every place is New York City. Okay, not every place is Seattle. In fact, Southern California, right, is not even close to either one of those places. Okay, so somebody's got to start making hard decisions about who gets to go back to work. Now, you keep the clamps on senior citizens, right? They can't go back to work if they work. People that are over the age of 60 with health complications, they can't go back either. So you've got to begin to get your X-Acto knife out and say, look, we cannot shut the United States down. You know, for, you know, it's like some of these things, like 6 months. Yeah, that can't happen. That can't happen. Okay? So somebody's got to make hard decisions. So that's got to be. There's also an interesting story in the LA Times today about a guy, a Nobel laureate, whose data tracking and said, this is not going to be, you know, this is not going to be months. Okay? And because of some of the mitigation efforts that countries have taken, you will see them be able to blunt their curves. So that's an article there. I don't have time to go into it today. So just wanted to say those things. The economic impact versus complete shutdown of the country, that's got to be evolved. And it's got to be evolved in a smart way. You're seeing the National Guard get called up. The other thing that needs to happen is I think most of you saw articles about, you know, calling for retired nurses, retired doctors to come back to work. And they had, I can't remember, a few thousand, 4,000 nurses and like 1,000 doctors volunteer. Amazing stuff. It's awesome. And I would tell you this, unaffected parts of the nation have to support the affected part of the nation. Okay. For instance, if the California National Guard mobilizes, it pulls doctors out of California hospitals. Well, we don't need that. So what's the state that's not, you know, impacted in a big way, right? Can we use their National Guard doctors, right, along with, you know, non-doctor California Guard people to put into California? The same thing with New York, okay? So people got to put on their smart, you know, boy and girl hats, right, and get after this, because keeping the nation shut down completely is a non-starter. So with all that said, hard decisions in the future. And it will come with some people. It's not going to be a perfect solution. Some people that will go back, you know, some spots will flare up, but the nation's got to work its way through this. Got to work its way through it. So once the testing's in place, right, and then I think you've got to let the people that aren't susceptible to this, you got to let them go back to work. Everybody else got to stay clear. So anyway, enough said. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it. Alex Holling is going to join us, so don't touch that dial. More of that next here on your home for here, all the All Warrior Radio Network.